Hello, and a very happy new year to all of you. Welcome back to the History of Scotland podcast. This is Fraser, your guide through the rich and intricate tapestry of Scotland's past. As we step into 2024, I want to extend my heartfelt thanks for the incredible support you've shown this podcast over the last year. Your enthusiasm and engagement has been the driving force behind our journey through Scotland's fascinating history. And what a journey it's been. We've been doing this podcast since 2020, so it's been a great journey so far, from the early Caledonian days against the Romans, through the Kingdom of Picts, through the Kingdom of Alba and Macbeth, to today's great episode, starting the reign of one of Scotland's longest reigning monarchs. Anyway, in our last episode, we delved into the laws, languages and culture of 12th century Scotland, exploring the social fabric that was in place right up until the end of King Malcolm IV's reign. We uncovered how these elements intertwined to shape the Scotland of that era, providing a crucial backdrop for the events and figures that followed. Today, we embark on a new chapter, turning our focus to a figure whose impact and importance on Scottish history is nothing short of legendary. We're going to delve into the reign of William I, also popularly known as William the Lion, a king whose story is woven with the threads of valour, conflict, and ambition. His reign marks a significant epoch in the annals of Scotland, one that offers an insight into the medieval landscape of power, politics, and personality. William I's story begins in 1142, born under the rule of his grandfather, King David I. It's a time of transformation and turmoil, with the shadows of power struggles and the glimmers of cultural and political evolution casting their shapes across the Scottish lands. As we explore his life and times, we'll witness how William the Lion positioned Scotland during a period fraught with challenges, both internal and external. Our narrative will stretch all the way to the cusp of the Great English Revolt of 1173, a pivotal moment that not just in Scottish history, but in the broader context of British and European affairs. This revolt, a complex tapestry of alliances, conflicts, and ambitions, saw William play a crucial role, one that would have lasting implications for Scotland. Our exploration will not just be a recounting of events and dates. Instead, we'll strive to understand William the Lion as a monarch and as a man. We'll delve into the decisions he made, the battles he fought, and the alliances he forged. But more importantly, we'll try to understand his motivations, his challenges, and his vision for Scotland. This will be a journey not just through the corridors of power, but also into the very heart of what it was meant to be a Scottish medieval monarch against the English. So, without further ado, let's embark on this remarkable journey together. Let's turn the pages back to the mid-12th century and bring to life the story of one of Scotland's most dynamic and influential monarchs, William. Stay tuned, as this episode promises to be a fascinating exploration of a pivotal figure in Scotland's storied history. In the annals of Scottish history, few figures stand as prominently as William I. His reign, spanning nearly 55 years from 1165 to 1214, marks one of the longest and most influential periods in medieval history of Scotland. To understand the significance of William I, it's essential to grasp not only his actions and policies, but also the context in which he ascended to the throne and the lasting impact of his reign. William's significance in Scotland's history can be attributed to several key aspects of his reign. First and foremost, he was a monarch of resilience and determination. His initial years as king were marked by challenges, including his capture by the English in 1174 and the subsequent Treaty of Fallouse, which placed Scotland under English overlordship. However, William's later successes in regaining Scotland's independence from this vassalage marked a turning point in his reign and in the history of Scottish-English relations. Moreover, William's era was a time of internal consolidation and external expansion. He continued the process of integrating Norman culture and systems into Scottish society, a task initiated by his predecessors. This integration was not just cultural, but also administrative, as William worked to strengthen royal authority and centralise his governance. His reign saw the expansion of further royal boroughs, the establishment of royal castles, and the introduction of silver coinage, all of which were critical in the development of a more modern and economically vibrant Scottish state. Even though there were previous kings had Scottish coins being minted, William decided to mint the coins in a rarer silver ore, which actually increased the value of these coins. William was also significant for his military campaigns and territorial ambitions. His efforts to expand Scottish influence into the north of England, while ultimately unsuccessful, demonstrated the growing power and ambition of the Scottish monarchy. Domestically, he worked to secure the Scottish borders, particularly with the Kingdom of the Isles and Galloway, regions that had long been sources of instability. You know, think of Somerled. Finally, the legacy of William the Lion is evident in his impact on Scottish national identity. His reign, though fraught with challenges, was a period of relatively stability and growth. The cultural and administrative challenges that occurred during his time helped forge a more unified and distinctive Scottish identity, setting the stage for the developments in the centuries to follow. Thus, as we explore the life and reign of William, we delve into the pivotal chapter in Scottish history. His story is one of a ruler navigating a complex landscape of internal challenges and external threats, England, all while laying the groundwork for the Scotland that we recognise today. William the Lion's reign is not just a tale of a king and his kingdom, it's a crucial part of a narrative of a nation's journey through the ages. And something would give, you know, let's say Edward Longshanks a bit of a chip on his shoulder when he came to invade Scotland. William was born in the year 1142 AD, during the reign of his grandfather, King David I of Scotland, a monarch whose rule, as we know, marked a pivotal moment in the shaping of medieval Scotland. David I, renowned for his efforts to modernise the kingdom and align it with European norms, was a key figure in introducing Norman culture and feudal systems to Scotland. William's birth in this era of transformation meant that from his earliest days, he was part of a royal environment that was at the crossroads of Gaelic traditions and the new Norman influences. William was the second son of Prince Henry of Scotland and Ada. His father, Henry, was the Earl of Northumbria and Huntingdon, and the heir apparent to the Scottish throne, making William a significant figure in the line of succession from his birth. Henry of Scotland himself was a notable figure, being the son of King David, as we know, and Maud, Countess of Huntingdon. His marriage to Ada, a member of the prominent Anglo-Norman family, further strengthened the Norman influence in the Scottish court. His father, as we know, died before David I passed, instantly passing the crown to his older brother, Malcolm IV. This death would have had an impact on William, greatly setting him on a closer course to kingship. William's position in the royal lineage was initially as a secondary figure due to his status as the second son. However, the early demise of his older brother, Malcolm IV, who succeeded David but died without heirs, dramatically altered William's destiny. With Malcolm's death in 1165, William ascended from a secondary role in the line of succession to become the primary heir and subsequently the King of Scotland. This shift in William's position from a likely nobleman to the ruler of Scotland set the stage for his long and impactful reign. His upbringing and straddling the old Gaelic traditions and the newer Norman customs would profoundly influence his policies as king and his approach to governance. The early years of William I thus paint a picture of a prince born into a world of rapid change and growing complexity, preparing him for the significant role he would later play in Scotland. William was likely raised in Scotland, possibly at the royal residences such as Edinburgh Castle, Stirling Castle, or the Royal Court at Scone, which was prominent centres of political and cultural life. Scottish monarchs of the time often moved between various castles and estates, and the royal children would typically accompany them. These homes served not only as a place to live, but also as centres for political administration and cultural activities, providing a fitting environment for a future king's upbringing. As was customary for royal offspring, William would have been placed under the care of a group of guardians and educators who were responsible for his safety, education, and training. These individuals were usually members of the nobility or the church, chosen for their loyalty and skill. Given the close ties between the Scottish and Norman courts at the time, it's likely that some of William's guardians and educators were Norman. One possible figure in William's early life could have been his mother, Ada. As a mother in a royal family, she would have played a significant role in his initial upbringing. Additionally, members of the clergy, particularly those associated with the royal court, would have been responsible for his religious and academic education. Figures like the Bishop of St Andrews or the Abbot of Dunfermline, prominent ecclesiastical positions in Scotland at the time, might have been involved in this aspect of this education. For his military training, something he would become very well known for, a crucial component for a prince, William would have been assigned a knight or a military commander as a mentor. This individual would have been responsible for teaching William the arts of war, including horsemanship, swordsmanship, and tactics. Given the martial focus of his reign later in life, this aspect of his education was undoubtedly rigorous. William's upbringing would have also been influenced by the broader environment of the Scottish royal court. The court was a melting pot of cultural influences, with both the Celtic Gaelic traditions and the Norman ones. This mix would have exposed William to a diverse range of cultural, linguistic, and political ideas, shaping his worldview and preparing him for the complexities of ruling a kingdom that was itself a blend of different cultures and traditions. As we know, during Malcolm IV's reign, though marked by significant challenges, including the internal revolts and conflicts with England, did not see the birth of any heirs. Malcolm was known for his piety. He also reportedly took a vow of celibacy, which meant that he did not produce any offspring to succeed him. The lack of an heir from Malcolm dramatically altered this line of succession. When he died in December 1165 without leaving any children, William, as we know, the only surviving brother, became the natural successor to the throne, and the succession was obviously following the primogeniture approach, which is something that we've covered many times now, which typically meant that the crown passed to the closest male relative in the absence of a direct heir. Upon the death of Malcolm, William ascended to the throne of Scotland. His coronation took place in December 1165, when he was only in his early 20s. The ceremony was held at Scone, the traditional site for the coronation of Scottish kings. This event marked the beginning of William's reign, which would last nearly 49 years, one of the longest in Scottish history. William's ascension to the throne was relatively smooth, largely due to the lack of other direct claimants and his legitimate place in the line of succession. However, his reign would soon face numerous challenges, both from within Scotland and from its powerful neighbour, England. But, as promised, let's actually go back to the crowning ceremony, the coronation, and what that entailed for Scottish kings. Well, the choice of Scone Abbey for the coronation of Scottish kings was deeply rooted in Scottish history. By the 12th century, Scone had already established itself as a site of major religious and political importance. The abbey, housing the revered Stone of Destiny, was not just a religious sanctuary but a symbol of Scottish sovereignty. The ceremony was steeped in religious and traditional rituals, reflecting the intertwining of the church and monarchy. It likely started with a procession led by the Scottish clergy, including figures such as the Bishop of St Andrews, who might have played a prominent role given the bishopric's prominence in Scotland at the time. Following the religious rites, the physical act of crowning the king was an immense symbolic importance. As per tradition, the Earl of Fife, a position then possibly held by Duncan II, would have the honour of placing William upon the Stone of Destiny. This act signified the Earl's crucial role in acknowledging and legitimising the new king's ascent to the throne. The crown used for William's coronation, though not elaborately described in historical records, was likely a symbol of royal authority rather than a lavish piece of jewellery. It may have been a simple gold band, emblematic of the king's role, rather than a reflection of wealth or opulence. The crown, along with other regalia such as a sceptre and sword, would symbolise the new king's responsibility to lead and protect his kingdom. He would kneel down, have the crown placed upon his head by the Earl of Fife, and then the Earl of Fife would scream, "Long live the King of Scotland! Long live the King!" The Stone of Destiny's use in the ceremony was a powerful emblem of Scottish monarchy. Legends associated with the stone were well known, including its supposed origins from the biblical times and its journey through Ireland to Scotland. The stone served not just as a throne, but as a testament to the enduring lineage of Scottish kingship. Following the religious and official aspects of the ceremony, a grand feast would have taken place at Scone, likely attended by various Scottish nobles, clan chiefs, church dignitaries, and foreign dignitaries. This celebration would have served both as a display of the new king's generosity and a crucial political event, where alliances would be forged and reaffirmed. Figures like the Earls of Strathearn, Angus, and Mar, powerful nobles of the time, might have been present, alongside representatives from the neighbouring regions and countries. In the days following the coronation, William I would begin the complex task of governance. This would involve consulting with his advisers and nobles, many of whom would have been present at the coronation. These discussions would set the tone for his initial policies and actions as king, addressing the immediate challenges within his kingdom and setting out his long-term vision for his reign, which may or may not involve England and a certain invasion. Though these are not full details of the process, and it isn't fully documented really till later on in Scotland's history, we still get a very rich picture of William I's coronation, an event that was not only a ceremonial passage, but a pivotal moment, setting for the stage for his nearly 50-year reign, a period that would significantly shape the course of Scottish history. And this ceremonial passage would be something that is repeated for many Scottish kings to come, even when the Stone of Destiny was critically robbed by Edward I, Edward Longshanks. Upon ascending to the throne in 1165, William faced several immediate challenges. One of the primary issues was consolidating his authority within Scotland. The kingdom was not a unified state in the modern sense, but a collection of territories often ruled by powerful local lords, chiefs, or mormers. William had to assert his authority over these regions and ensure their loyalty, a task complicated by the diverse and sometimes fractious nature of his realm. Another challenge was the ongoing tension with England. The Scottish-English border had long been a source of conflict, and William inherited a situation where he had to defend Scottish interests while managing a powerful and often aggressive neighbour to the south. Think of his brother, Malcolm IV, giving away all of his English lands and only taking on the Earl of Huntingdon, giving it away to Henry, King of England, so that way he could be legitimised. Now that William's come to the throne, what can William give away to Henry? Probably nothing, which is why William is being more aggressive. William was known for his efforts to centralise and strengthen royal authority in Scotland as well. He continued the work of his grandfather David I in bringing Norman administrative practices to Scotland. This included the establishment of a royal chancery, which helped in maintaining records and managing royal decrees. Something that England already had was a royal chancery, but now Scotland was having one as well, and William I is credited at bringing in the first royal chancery recorded in Scotland. He also worked on the development of a feudal system in Scotland, granting lands in return for military service, such as his predecessors. This helped stabilise his rule. Additionally, William founded several royal boroughs, which were towns granted certain privileges, such as the right to hold markets as we know. Some of these royal boroughs were placed in the northern part of Scotland, crucially expanding the Norman way and feudal way of life to the outer reaches of the Kingdom of Scotland. William's relationship with neighbours, particularly England, was complex. His desire to regain control over Northumbria, which we know Scotland had lost under his king and brother Malcolm IV, led to these future conflicts coming with the Scottish monarchy. The ambition put him at odds with King Henry II of England, leading to military confrontations. We will see most of this come to a head in next week's episode. In addition to England, William had to manage relations with the other neighbours, such as the Kingdom of Norway, which had interests in the Isles and the west coast of Scotland. His diplomacy in these matters were crucial in maintaining Scotland's independence and territorial integrity. During William's early reign, there were several notable cultural and economic developments. We've obviously mentioned the royal boroughs, but he also continued to integrate the Norman culture into the royal court. Though certain Gaelic and Celtic chiefs would not be happy with this, William continued to expand the Norman way of life at court, bringing in new ways of traditions, new waves of living, laws, etc. Things will come into more detail in later episodes. William, having been raised in a period where martial skills were highly prized among nobility, would have been well versed in the art of warfare from a young age. He likely received personal training in combat, strategy and leadership, essential skills for a medieval monarch. As a king, William would have extended this martial ethos to his nobles and soldiers, different from his brother Malcolm IV. He likely encouraged this time and possibly organised military training exercises for his knights, chiefs and men-at-arms, improving on their combat skills, discipline and readiness for war. William's army would have been composed of a mixture of lightly armoured fighters, better known as feudal levies, Scottish Norman knights and Gaelic clan chiefs, with a small composition of Irish mercenaries. The feudal levy system, where lords were obliged to provide a certain number of troops to the king in times of war, was a backbone of this military force. These levies would have been drawn from across Scotland, each lord bringing men from his own lands. They were lightly armoured, allowing a very much hit-and-run tactic. In addition to feudal levies, knights were the elite fighting force of the time, and they played this crucial role to perfection. These knights, often landholders themselves, were heavily armoured cavalrymen. They were trained in combat and loyal to the king, but there wasn't a massive amount of royal cavalry in William's time. You know, we still haven't got to the greater numbers that would be in Scotland's later years. William would have relied on mainly Scottish light armoured fighters for the prowess, but allowed his knights to outflank and encircle the enemy. Plus, we obviously had the skirmishers such as archers, such as longbowmen and crossbowmen, and javelin throwers. Moreover, William is known to have employed these mercenaries, these Irish mercenaries. They supplemented his forces with troops skilled in particular aspects of warfare that might have been lacking in his regular lightly armoured forces. William's immediate military preparations were not just about immediate campaigns, but also about ensuring Scotland's long-term defensive capabilities. This involved fortifying castles and border defences, a strategy that was crucial in the face of the ongoing threat from England. Castles such as Edinburgh, Stirling, Roxburgh, Berwick were key to Scotland's defensive network. William also worked on improving Scotland's naval capabilities, recognising the importance of maritime strength that Somerled once led an invasion from, and in protecting Scotland's extensive coastline and trade interests. This naval development was important in safeguarding against the invasions and inserting Scottish presence in contested areas like the Isle of Man and the Western Isles. But for William to invade England successfully and not fail like his grandfather David I, he would need an ally. And who better of an ally than the King of France? A king who hated the English king just as much as William did. The King of France during William's reign was Louis VII until about 1180 AD, and then it was Philip II. William's engagement with the French monarchy was part of his broader strategy to strengthen Scotland's international alliances and position himself against English influence. This was particularly pertinent to prepare for his planned coming invasion of England. William likely initiated communication with the French king as part of a diplomatic effort to find allies who could counterbalance the overpowering influence of England. This would have been conducted through envoys and letters, the standard diplomatic channels of the time. The alliance with France was not just political but also strategic. In a move of larger context of European power dynamics, where France and England were often in opposition. The relationship with France, while not leading to intermediate military alliances or direct intervention, was significant in framing Scotland's foreign policy. It demonstrated William's desire to establish Scotland as a sovereign power in Europe, capable of forming alliances with major kingdoms. This move would have been a clear signal to England of Scotland's intention to seek powerful friends and resist English dominance. Domestically, William's reign was marked by challenges of managing the diverse cultural and political landscape of Scotland as well. This involved balancing the interests of the powers of the traditional Gaelic chiefs and the newly settled Norman nobles. William employed a strategy of integration and accommodation. He continued the policy started by his grandfather of granting lands and titles to Norman knights, which helped to solidify the feudal system in Scotland. These Normans were used to strengthen royal authority and modernise the administration of these areas they were given. William was also aware of the importance of the Gaelic chiefs, however, who held this significant power and historical legacy of Scotland, especially in the Highlands and the Isles. He needed their support to ensure the stability and unity of his kingdom. To this end, William likely engaged in a delicate balancing act, granting favours and positions to Gaelic chiefs, ensuring their loyalty, and sometimes even involving them in the governance of the kingdom. This approach would have involved personal diplomacy, negotiations, and sometimes concessions to Gaelic customs and laws. In managing these two distinct groups, William had to be a skilled diplomat and a shrewd politician. And to be honest, he was both. But he didn't do this alone. He had a royal council. Detailing the specific names of the royal council members and major barons during William's reign can be challenging due to the limited and sometimes ambiguous historical records from the 12th century. However, we can identify some key figures based on some of the historical accounts I have read. So, talking about council members, the Chancellor was a crucial figure, often a cleric, responsible for the royal seal and the administration of royal charters and documents. For a period, Hugh de Roxburgh served as Chancellor during William's reign. So that's Hugh de Roxburgh serving as Chancellor. Justiciar. The role of the Justiciar was to administer justice and oversee the legal system. In William's time, this role was likely held by a series of individuals, potentially including figures like Walter FitzAlan or David de Ulfiant. Steward slash seneschal. Well, the stewards managed the royal household and estates. Walter FitzAlan, as we know, was the founder of the Stuart dynasty, and he is known to have served in this role during William's reign, carrying on the FitzAlan legacy at being the steward of Scotland. Chamberlain. Overseeing the financial matters, the Chamberlain was a key position. Alistair Sotteville is an example of a Chamberlain during this period under William I. But what about the baronage under William I? Well, as always, it included a mix of Gaelic and Norman individuals. Some of the key Norman barons, the greater ones of this time, were Walter FitzAlan, Richard de Morville, and William de Beaumont. Richard de Morville held a position as Constable of Scotland, and he was a significant Norman baron. William de Beaumont was Earl of Buchan and was a prominent figure in the Scottish nobility. In terms of the Gaelic chiefs and barons, we had Gilchrist, Earl of Angest, who was a Gaelic noble and represented the traditional Scottish chiefs. We had Malcolm, Earl of Fife. The Macduff family of Fife was prominent, with Malcolm being a key figure during this period. And then we had Gaelic Brigadate, the Earl of Strathearn, another powerful Gaelic lord indicative of the influence of Gaelic nobility in William's reign. So that's Gaelic Brigadate. These individuals, among others, played significant roles in the governance, military campaigns, and diplomatic efforts during William's reign. But also under William's reign, we had the Balliols, who would have been involved in further administration and governance of their lands. And then we obviously had the de Bruce family, headed by Robert de Bruce during much of William's reign. He had the lordship of Arndale. Although we are actually up to Robert de Bruce II here, and not the first Robert de Bruce, the one who, you know, betrayed King David I. Both the Balliol and de Bruce families were part of the wider process of Normanisation of the Scottish nobility. Though neither party are in the inner circle, they are still crucial families in the great Scottish nation. Anyway, imagine the scene at Edinburgh Castle. William the Lion is there in his court preparing the invasion of England when a cleric rushes in. This cleric informs him of a coming revolt in England. This revolt is the revolt of 1173 to 1174, a significant uprising against King Henry II of England, and it was a pivotal moment in the reign of William. Understanding the contributing factors to this revolt, William's role in it, and the political and social landscape of Scotland at this time provides crucial context to the events that followed. The revolt of 1173 to 1174 against Henry II was fueled by a combination of factors. first of which was Henry II's policies. Henry's attempts to centralise power and his administrative reforms had created discontent among the English nobles, who felt their traditional privileges were being eroded. You know, we're talking about the Plantagenet Empire here, the massive kingdom going all the way from the northern borders of Scotland all the way down to the Duchy of Aquitaine. So Henry was very much focused in his lands in France and the Duchy of Aquitaine, and less about his English lands. Family conflict as well. Henry II's sons, notably the young King Henry, Richard, who would be later known as Richard the Lionheart, and Geoffrey, supported their mother, Eleanor of Aquitaine, who rebelled against their father's authority, seeking greater power and autonomy. Dissatisfaction with Henry II's rule extended beyond his immediate family, with various English and Norman barons as well as other rulers, including the King of France, seeking an opportunity to assert their own power and settle grievances. Now backdrop this with William I's decision to form an alliance with France, and this was a significant move against Henry. This alliance was part of a broader coalition against Henry II. You know, we had the French king, Louis VII, and then we had Henry's sons. William's participation was motivated by his desire to regain control of Northumbrian territories lost by his brother. So this alliance worsened his standing with Henry II, but it positioned William as a direct adversary, ensuring the conflict would come into play. On the eve of the revolt, Scotland was experiencing a period of relatively internal stability and consolidation under William's rule. He had worked well to strengthen the royal authority and integrate the Norman culture, establish the feudal systems in greater effect of regions such as Moray. However, there were still underlying tensions. Obviously, we had the Norman Gaelic dynamics that was going on and the Gaelic chiefs feeling a bit left out, but the border tensions between England and Scotland had worsened, and with William keen to assert Scottish claims over the contested areas, he was ready. And obviously he was ready from this military preparedness that we mentioned earlier on. William had focused on strengthening Scotland's military capabilities from the get-go, anticipating potential conflicts with England. In this context, the revolt of 1173 and 74 presented both an opportunity and a risk for William I. It was a chance to assert Scottish interests against a preoccupied English monarchy, but it also involved entering a broader conflict with a significant military and diplomatic implications. Think about it. Think about this alliance that has been formed. We have the King of France, we've got Henry II's sons turning against him, his own wife, and now William is going to jump into the fray and try and, you know, take away some land whilst hopefully Henry II is preoccupied in France. Hopefully none of the Norman earls will stand in his way. But William gathered his army and began to march in England. He was ready to take the fight to the English and reclaim the lands of his grandfather, beat back what his older brother stupidly did by giving away the lands that should have been rightfully his. But did he succeed in this? Well, we'll have to find out more next week. With the end of this episode, as always, I'd like to mention our historical sources used to bring this episode to life. So key references include Scotland, The Story of a Nation by Magnus Magnusson, which provides a comprehensive overview of Scottish history, including William's reign. The Kingdom of the Scots, Governance, Church and Society from the 11th to the 14th century by J.W.S. Barrow. This offers a detailed insight into Scotland's political and ecclesiastical developments during this period. And for a closer look at the dynamics of William's time, The Scottish Kings by Gordon Donaldson is a useful resource. These works, among others, have contributed to a nuanced understanding of William I's complex and impactful reign. As we move forward, our journey through William's reign will continue in the upcoming episodes. The next episode, we will focus on the intriguing and pivotal English revolt of 1173 to 1174 and examine William's role in this significant historical event. How did the invasion go? Did he succeed in taking this Northumbrian lands that he wanted? Did he manage to kick the English back to London? Well, we'll find out in this deep dive into one of the most tumultuous periods of William's reign, and it promises to be both enlightening and engaging. I wonder if he will succeed, and I keep saying, as in questioning, if he will succeed, as a hint for you guys not to go spoil the ending by looking it up on Google. Anyway, after this, we have a further 5 episodes covering William's reign, from his nobles to a crusade catch-up to the rest of his long and troubled reign. Why was it troubled? Well, we'll soon find out. Remember, our podcasts are released weekly, with the next episode scheduled for release next month. We produce 3 episodes a month to ensure each one is crafted with attention to detail and historical accuracy you've come to expect. I haven't managed to redo the second episode of this podcast series yet, so I'm going to set that as a task of Q1 of this year to get it done, so I'll keep you updated on that. But if you want to stay updated in different ways, please connect to us via following our Twitter at the handle @thehistoryofSC1, that is @thehistoryofSC1, and our Facebook page at the History of Scotland podcast. Your engagement and feedback keep this journey through Scotland's past vibrant and alive. We've hit over 60 members in the Facebook group, and I think we're on about 30 followers on Twitter. So thank you for the upcoming support there. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your preferred podcasting platform. Your reviews are always appreciated and help us reach more listeners passionate about Scottish history. You can listen to our podcast on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbean, and many other excellent podcasting sites. But until next week, guys, thank you for spending your time with us. Have a fantastic week ahead, and we look forward to bringing you more fascinating tales from Scotland's rich history. But until then, stay safe. Goodbye for now, guys, and I'll see you all on the next one. Peace.